This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time for us to discuss this past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
We also have Anthony Chabaterwe.
Greetings.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
Last Sunday was Bastille Day in France, and they commemorated their national holiday by celebrating and showcasing the European Army. For this story, we'll go to Richard.
Yes, I think this is pretty remarkable. I mean, imagine the July 4th parade under Mr. Trump. It got a whole lot of news. But imagine instead of that being, say, an American tank parked out there on the mall or wherever it was that everyone was drawing attention to, imagine if you had Mexican and Canadian soldiers marching down there alongside American soldiers outside the or in Washington, D.C. to celebrate America's national holiday. That would be a pretty big change of attitude for America. It would be remarkable. It would be a huge commitment, a huge symbolic commitment to some kind of military union with Mexico and Canada. What we had in France is similar to that. You know, this is July 14th. It's every bit as much France's National Day as July 4th is, that Bastille Day, commemorating the storming of the Bastille in the French Revolution. And they really wanted to draw attention to, I mean, this is often a big military parade in France, but they really wanted to draw attention to this European dimension. So they had over 4,000 armed forces personnel, nearly 200 vehicles, nearly 100 aeroplanes. Perhaps most memorably, they had the flying soldier that was some soldier on a newfangled kind of flying hoverboard thing. He was particularly impressive, but the whole thing, quite an impressive spectacle, but it all revolving around a European military. And one of the things that's really eye-catching is it was a European military union made up of 10 nations.
Mm.
And, you know, well, that pops off right off one of the top things that we're watching, because the Bible prophesies that you're going to get a military union in Europe made up of 10 nations. There are several different symbolic prophecies that talk about this 10 nations. Revelation chapter 17 describes a beast that has 10 horns, and it says that these 10 horns are 10 kings that all share power together. So you've got 10 kings. And then Daniel chapter 2, it describes an image, and different parts of this image are symbolic of different empires. And right at the bottom, you have 10 toes on this image. And it says again that these are 10 kings. So you've got this power coming with 10 kings, and then you have in France a military parade with 10 different nations. And Herbert W. Armstrong, because of those prophecies, said for years to watch for exactly that. Now, the 10 nations that we saw in Europe, that's not going – it isn't – these aren't the final 10 kings. Britain is a part of – they were one of those 10 nations. These are 10 nations that are involved in the European Intervention Initiative, where they're coming together and trying to form a more aggressive military union that can deploy overseas. So Britain was a part of that. You can put together other scriptures and see Britain is clearly not going to be a part of those coming 10 kings. And also, these prophecies make clear that you're going to have 5 kings from Eastern Europe, 5 kings from Western Europe. These 10 were mostly from the West. So there's some changes there, but it's still really interesting that you have France saying, we're really committed to a European military. We're going to celebrate it on our national holiday. And they had a whole load of other military initiatives to go with this, by the way, that they're announcing. And whenever they say, okay, we need to work together and form a military, it's kind of hard to do it with these 27 nations in the European Union. You just about always end up with 10 nations. And there have been several different military initiatives over the years made up of 10 nations. There was the so-called Berlin Group that was also 10 nations. So they end up with a union that's exactly the same kind of size that we've talked about and that the Bible talks about. And sure, some of those who exactly is involved is going to be tweaked a bit, but that's the size of the military union that we're looking at.
Yeah, anyone who has followed the Trumpet and Herbert W. Armstrong for any time had to have been quite impressed to see a group of 10 nations marching in a military parade through France. I guess the it's interesting that Emmanuel Macron is certainly it's not lost on him the symbolic importance of this taking place on Bastille Day in France. You mentioned that he had several other initiatives here. Can you just put this in context that this has never happened before on Bastille Day, where a French president has shown this kind of symbolic commitment to a European army? What are his, we've talked about the fact that he's basically trying to position himself as the champion of tomorrow's Europe and show just how committed he is to European unification. Where does this fit into this, the fact that he's willing to say on Bastille Day, we're going to put this kind of European force on display in this way?
Yeah, it fits right in with that. And some of those other things that were announced, for example, they announced that he's going to form a joint space command inside France. They launched a new type of $10 billion nuclear-powered submarine. So they're really also trying to put on display military union. And at the same time, they're trying to send the message, France is Europe's great military power. And so I think he sees what we see in Europe. He sees what we see in Germany, where Germany is the strongest nation in Europe, the most populous nation in Europe, the most prosperous nation in Europe, but they have weak leadership right now. And I think he thinks that if he pushes really hard on the military front, and at the moment France has a bigger military than Germany, I think he thinks that if he kind of seizes the moment while Germany has weak leadership, then perhaps he can have some kind of French-led European military union, and that he'll end up basically leading this thing. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory he wrote about some of that. He had a couple of different articles on the way France is behaving and the way France is really pushing towards a military union. But as he wrote it's even the title of one of his articles, France rejects America and empowers Germany. That's really going to be the outcome of this. I think he might think that he can become a mini Napoleon, as Nigel Farage called him on the floor of the European Parliament this week. But at the end of the day, Germany is the one with all the power. Germany is the one that the Bible says is going to end up in charge. And so once they've got a strong leader, France will, they may well end up doing a lot of legwork to kind of bring this together before that happens. But at the end of the day, all they're going to end up doing is empowering Germany.
Yeah, talk for a bit about Ursula von der Leyen. She was just elected as President of the European Commission. She's also another strong European leader, or she's certainly a prominent European leader who is pushing for a united army.
She is, and I don't know, maybe Jesse might want to fit in the speech from Nigel Farage in the run-up to her election in the European Parliament this week, where he gave a really strong speech talking about her track record for trying to push for a European army. She's as defense minister of Germany, she's brought in other military groups or other military units into the German army. You've got a significant chunk of the Dutch army serving in the German army. You've got Czech and Romanian tank forces being incorporated into the German army. She's said that this is part of an effort to create a multinational European tank brigade that could form a nucleus of a European army. So she's made real practical steps towards a European army. And Nigel Farage was up there saying, you put these people in charge, and within 5 years, you will have a fully functioning European defense initiative. It will not be democratic. It will not be controlled by parliament. And anything that can be used for defense can also be used to attack. Mm-hmm. So you've got someone, she's close to Angela Merkel. There's still a lot of weakness there. She's not necessarily a strong leader, but she is really committed to pushing for a European military. And so you could really see that making huge bounds under her tenure now as the European Commission president.
Watching what Emmanuel Macron has done here really does point back to what Gerald Flory wrote on the cover of the Trumpet not too long ago, where he was talking about France turning its back on America and empowering Germany.
That's right. Yeah, that article, that's the title of the article. France rejects America and empowers Germany, from the February Trumpet print edition. It goes through some of, Emmanuel Macron went and visited Berlin towards the end of last year. He said France loves Germany. And he had a lot of very hostile statements about the United States. You see that all over this story as well, from even just this week, with hostile statements about the United States coming out of France, and then looking to Germany and looking towards this European Union to oppose it. So that article from Mr. Flurry is a great place to understand what's going on here, and what the Bible prophesies about France, about Germany, and about this European military. So that's France rejects America and empowers Germany.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes for today's program. We also have an article up on the website by Daniel DeSanto. Bastille Day showcases European military cooperation. Find both of those on thetrumpet.com. Thanks for that, Richard. The debate in the United States over immigration is getting hotter as those who advocate loosening the immigration policy grow more radical. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there's a major protest in Denver, Colorado last Friday that reveals just how radical the immigration debate in America has become. And for a little bit of context, in Denver, Colorado, close as we can tell, there's 50,000 illegal immigrants living there. The federal court system has ruled that about 4% of these immigrants, roughly 2,000, are so radical that they need to be deported from the country as soon as possible. And so the Trump administration decided that they'll follow through with this, deport those 2,000 illegal immigrants, let the other 48,000 stay. And even this, just the decision to deport the 4% most radical illegal immigrants in Denver was enough to get a major demonstration at an Immigrations and Customs Enforcement office in Denver. About 2,000 people showed up to demonstrate. Demonstrations largely peaceful, but they actually were able to force themselves onto the ICE, Immigration Customs and Enforcement Center, tear down the American flag, and hoist up the Mexican flag in its place. And so... You're really bringing, I mean, the talking points over something like this is like, oh, we're just trying to stand up for the rights of refugees who want to come to America for a better life, which this demonstration exposes as a lie, because you're not talking about refugees. You're talking about the 4% most radical criminals who came to this city, and you're tearing down your own nation's flag. To putting up the flag of the nation these immigrants came from, revealing that actually on both the sides of those immigrants, at least those 2,000 immigrants and the 2,000 demonstrators, yours is not actually about asylum or even immigration. This is more like Mexican colonialism, sending people to like stake a claim in Colorado. And now have Mexican flags flying at the centers of government in the state.
This is pretty eye-popping visual, having the United States flag pulled down, raising the Mexican flag. But this really is just one incident in what is increasingly being exposed by Democrats and even these mainstream candidates for president in the Democrat Party of really wanting something close to completely open borders.
Right, and it's pretty much getting to the point where the Democratic Party is publicly advocating for that. I mean, for decades, they've always been pretty lax on enforcing America's border laws. And now they're... like I said, this particular demonstration is against deporting people who've been ruled by a federal judge are too radical to be here. And this is one of the more extreme incidents because of the eye-popping visual you mentioned. But it is something that, I mean, across the nation, there's anywhere between 11 and 30 million illegal immigrants, depending on the study you cite. They have deported almost none of the ones who've been here for a considerable period of time. You've got Congress trying to block every time every effort to enforce border law. You've got representatives talking about with the abolish ICE movement, saying mm-hmm. that we actually even just need to get rid of our don't build a wall. We actually need to get rid of the agency in charge of defending the borders. You look at like Democratic primary debates, and pretty much every candidate said they were in favor of free health care for illegal immigrants, mm-hmm. which is pretty much, you combine those two systems, it's pretty much like anyone in the world with a health problem can just come here and have the one of the 300 million American citizens pay for it with their tax dollars.
So many of the policies that they're protesting were the same as the policies that were in place under the Obama administration. And yet, because Donald Trump is president and their animus against him is so strong, virtually anything that the government tries to do in order to enforce our own immigration laws is viewed as evil and immoral.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that is one thing I think is important to remember is like you got the progressive movement and the Democrat movement. It's about moving America continually further to the left. And so if you look at someone like President Trump, I mean, a lot of his policies are very liberal compared to past Republican presidents. Mm-hmm. He's one of the very few presidents in American history that's moving America back the other direction. And so yeah, you can claim maybe he's moving America back to as conservative as it was under Bill Clinton, but it's the fact...
Or Barack Obama, as the case may be.
So it's not so much the policy, like you said, that they hate as much, because some of them were in place under past Democratic presidents, but it's the fact that he's actually moving America back the other way when for decades it's been drifting further and further left. And it is, I mean, I think the Bible term to describe the spirit would be iniquity is the word usually translated in the King James Version as lawlessness, which is just the spirit of just ignore the law. They'll quote something like Numbers 15 verse 16, which says that there should be one law for both you and the stranger that sojourns with you, and then try to use that to prove that, like, okay, well, you have to treat foreigners the same way you treat anyone else in the nation, and try to make the case that, like, a border is unbiblical.
Have you actually heard people quoting that, Numbers 15, 16, in this context?
I've heard... yes, I think there's a couple similar verses in
the
Old Testament.
Well, there are the verses that say, like, you know, you should love the stranger, and I've heard people say that. But that particular verse, I mean, the way that they're using it is, in my view, exactly the opposite of what that verse is saying, because they have one standard for illegal immigrants that they say, you know, basically these people who are coming in illegally should be above the law. At the same time that they're holding Americans to a standard that they're not holding the illegal immigrants. So there are definitely two different standards. It would just be kind of extraordinary if that's the verse that they're using. But like you said, they're quoting the Bible saying, well, we're supposed to love the stranger as in order to justify, you know, open borders, whatever these immigrants want to do, we need to accommodate them.
Right. Because I mean, there's definitely verses that they said anyone who comes here legally and submits to the law, you should have one law for everyone. But that's not what's happening. So these are people who've actually broken the law to come here. And there's also plenty of other verses in these same chapters that talk about that. Like, so no, if you've broken the law, then the punishment for that is deportation.
Right.
I think the Bible uses the term exile, but it's but the emphasis is on law.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting to just see this manifestation of this spirit of lawlessness that Gerald Fleury has drawn attention to time after time. It's just to an extraordinary degree that they're willing to shove the law aside and say, whatever we think in this case, anybody who wants to enforce the law is a racist, to the detriment of our own country. It's just a phenomenal degree. Quite amazing to see that. We'll put a link to Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law, in the show notes, where he talks about just how important it is that we uphold the rule of law and the incredible destruction that takes place when the law is pushed aside. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to the Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. China is continuing its aggressive actions in the South China Sea. To learn the latest, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, starting back in May, China has been actively blocking oil and gas drilling operations both in Malaysian and Vietnamese waters in the South China Sea. There's a new analysis that was published on Tuesday by the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative. And for the Malaysian situation, the evidence here shows that throughout most of May, a Chinese vessel has heavily patrolled waters near the Luconia breakers. That's on the Malaysian continental shelf, and it's well within Malaysia's internationally recognized exclusive economic zone. So this unusual Chinese patrolling included several passes through Block SK-308. That's where, right now, there are some Malaysian-led gas drilling operations underway. And a Chinese vessel has circled provocatively close to, that's a quote from this report, circled provocatively close to ships that were servicing a rig in this block. And they came to, apparently, about 250 feet of this rig. And then the Chinese have used very similar tactics in Vietnamese waters since June. The Vietnamese right now are drilling there with a Russian company, actually, and they have a drilling rig in Block 0601. That's in Vietnamese waters. And a Chinese ship maneuvered. It found some supply ships from Vietnam that were sort of servicing this rig. And once again, it maneuvered at very high speeds. It circled provocatively close. And in this case, in the Vietnamese waters, the Chinese and Vietnamese vessels have actually been engaged in a standoff ever since then. So that's for more than a week now. But in both of these cases, China's harassment has occurred within the internationally recognized waters, within the exclusive economic zones of Vietnam and Malaysia. But China, of course, doesn't recognize those international parameters. Instead, it uses its notorious nine-dash line to claim virtually the entire South China Sea as its own. So it feels like it's entitled to do this.
So it's accusing these nations of drilling where they shouldn't be drilling, and it's drilling wherever it wants to drill.
Right. Yeah, actually, at the exact same time as this is happening, a new fleet of Chinese vessels has started surveying, actually in that same block, Block 0601, well within Vietnam's waters. So these Chinese vessels are now starting their own new exploration and exploitation efforts in this very block where they just ousted the Vietnamese. And this is clearly Vietnam space. So this analysis by the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative does point out just the arrogant double standard that's at play here for China. I'll read a short quote from it. It says, "China's actions off both the Malaysian and Vietnamese coasts show that Beijing is increasingly willing to employ coercion and the threat of force to block oil and gas explorations by its neighbors, even while pursuing its own energy exploration in disputed waters." So it really is an egregious double standard there. And then one final quote I'll read here from the Transparency Initiative. It says, due to the close quarters and provocative behavior on display, there is, quote, a clear risk that an accidental collision could lead to escalation.
So it's quite amazing to see China taking these moves, which it's hard not to see these as provocative and aggressive and militaristic in a way, at the same time that it's trying to kind of woo the region into trade relationships and to the way that it's talking about just uniting the region and drawing them into greater economic cooperation. In some ways, it seems like it's kind of like we were talking about last week when they actually, their defense minister comes out and says, yes, this is going to be used for military purposes. Any of these neighbors, we've talked about the Philippines kind of being in this troubled relationship with China. Yeah. Here we're talking about Malaysia and Vietnam. They have to recognize China for what it is, that there really is. I mean, it's you have to cooperate with them or you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's sort of curious sometimes to see China simultaneously using both the carrot and the stick. You know, you would think it would try one or the other tactic. We want to woo you with friendly overtures and gestures, or we want to threaten force and use coercion to force you. But instead, within the course of a week, you'll see both from China. But yeah, for whatever reason, though, it seems that these less powerful Asian nations, despite the hypocrisy, despite the kind of seemingly opposed tactics there, they still are slowly moving into China's orbit. Perhaps not voluntarily.
Put it into prophetic context for us.
Sure, yes. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has said that China's takeover of this strategic region, the South China Sea, and just all its very increasingly belligerent behavior there will indeed lead to a dramatic escalation, just like the Asia Transparency Initiative wrote there. In our July 2016 issue, he wrote about this. He said, China's bullying of less powerful nations in the region is, quote, steering the world toward war. And he said, everything is headed in the direction of war. That's a quote from his, it was actually the cover story of the Philadelphia Trumpet that month. And Mr. Flurry explained that his analysis of that whole South China Sea dynamic is based on Bible prophecy. He pointed to a prophecy in Deuteronomy 28:52, where God warns the nations of Israel that if they reject him, he would give control over the world's strategic sea gates to their enemies. And those gates include the ones that allow access to the South China Sea, places like Hong Kong, where just in 1997 we saw that handed over from Britain to China. So Mr. Flurry also explained that that's, well, I'll read a short quote here. It says, "It is a prophecy for the modern day descendants of Israel. Two nations in particular represent Israel in this end time, America and Britain." So right now, China's hindering of these drilling efforts by India or by Vietnam and Malaysia in their own waters, that wouldn't be happening if America and Britain were still in control of this area. So this is a pretty dramatic fulfillment of that prophecy. This Chinese bullying and China's general takeover of this strategic region, it shows that this prophecy in Deuteronomy is in the process of being fulfilled.
Thanks for that, Jeremiah. We will put a link to that article, China is Steering the World Toward War, in the show notes. And also, Jeremiah has an article, China Bullying Malaysia and Vietnam in the South China Sea, that should be going up on the website on Monday. Still more developments in the rising tensions between the United States and Iran. For this story, we'll turn to Anthony Chibadurwe.
Iran's aggression in the Persian Gulf has continued again this week. And it all started on Sunday with news reports that an oil tanker had just vanished from the Strait of Hormuz. Of course, adding to the tensions in that region. At that time, many people suspected that Iran was involved, but they were not really sure. They thought that maybe the tanker might have malfunctioned. But the truth finally came out yesterday when Iran announced that it had seized that ship. It said that the seized tanker was a Panamanian tanker, or was Panamanian flagged. It was reportedly carrying 250,000 gallons of oil, which Iran says that was smuggled Iranian oil. And when Iran made the announcement, oil prices just skyrocketed. And these are prices that actually had been going down in the past week or so. And they just skyrocketed, just indicating how tense the situation is getting. And yes, the United States responded very, very strongly against Iran. It said that, this is a statement from the State Department, it says that the U.S. strongly condemns the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps for continued harassment of vessels and interference with safe passage in and around the Strait of Hormuz. It talks about Iran's illicit activity and just said that we will continue to work with our allies and partners to ensure that this doesn't continue. There have been reports that Britain, one of America's allies, is sending a third warship to the region. There was also reports just this week that Japan, too, is also considering sending some warships to the Strait of Hormuz just to safeguard that region because of what Iran has been doing just in the past few weeks. And also yesterday, as a sign of the escalation of tensions in the region, the United States announced yesterday morning that it had downed an Iranian drone that was getting close to a U.S. naval ship, and it said that it was actually endangering the ship. So this is just a lot of tense developments in the region. And these actually have been, it's just been 1 week after the other, and it's bringing in more nations. It's drawing them more involved in this region, particularly because of oil, because a lot of nations do rely on oil, and if that oil supply is jeopardized in any way, that's a big problem for many economies.
It's a little difficult to see exactly where this is going to go in the short term. It does seem like the United States has had some degree of success in punishing Iran economically, and in some ways you could look at what Iran is doing maybe as a bit of desperation to try to counteract some of those effects. But we know, prophetically speaking, that in the long run, that the United States is not going to be the one that that actually brings Iran to heel, that it's going to have to come from a European force. At this point, the United States is definitely the main protagonist in terms of trying to limit Iran's activity.
Yes, and there are many people in the region, particularly in Europe, who have said that, look, the security of this region is really our responsibility, particularly because of their dependence on Middle Eastern oil and also on how close they are to this region. They can be affected a whole lot more by the instability in the Middle East, far more than the United States is right now.
Not to mention Iranian missiles.
Yes, they are within range, actually.
Yeah. So we'll definitely keep our eyes on what's going on in there. It is important. Anybody watching this region, the overview that prophecy gives us as to what Iran is going to be doing in the future definitely puts this in context. If you want to know the long-term prognosis of what is going to be happening here, maybe you could recommend a couple of resources that people could look at.
Well, the first one is an article that Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote in back in 2015, and it's titled, Iran Gets a Stranglehold on the Middle East. And this article goes into Iran's strategy just to have more influence in this region. Starting with the control of those sea gates close to Yemen, where it's been sponsoring Houthi rebels, and Iran knows the importance of those regions, those sea gates, and it wants more leverage. Really, it wants more leverage to continue its own policies, and these sea gates can give it a whole lot of power, and that's what it wants. And the Bible does talk a lot about Iran's aggression, and this article by Mr. Fleury goes into that, into those prophecies about Iran's interest in this region and what the Bible say will be the final outcome of that.
Yeah, like you mentioned, you'd have to think that there would be a lot of Europeans who are watching these increased aggressions on Iran's part and realizing at some point they are going to have to step in and intervene if they want to secure that oil. So we appreciate you bringing that to us, Anthony. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about Germany's secret missions in North Africa. that were uncovered this week. And also the Trump administration drawing attention to the importance of religious freedom. These stories and more when we get back from this break.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It was revealed this week that Germany has had secret foreign military operations and is considerably more involved militarily in North Africa than was previously realized. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so Germany recently announced that it would be bringing soldiers home from Cameroon. And the response to this was, wait, Germany had soldiers in Cameroon? And it's drawn attention to something quite remarkable, because under Germany's constitution, the German government has to get the German parliament to sign off on any military mission. Without explicit approval from the parliament, the soldiers can't go. And so it was quite remarkable for Germany to have these soldiers there in Cameroon, and Parliament hadn't signed off on it and didn't know anything about it. And so this has shed light on this story where actually the German government has tweaked a bit how they interpret the Constitution. And they've decided, at some point in the last few years, they decided that if those troops were going overseas and they weren't aimed to be involved in combat, but were in they said if it's a hazardous mission that's training in a hazardous area, we will still go and ask Parliament's permission. But if it's an area not deemed hazardous, we will send it there and we're not going to ask the German Parliament for permission. And this has ended up shedding light on actually a whole bunch more German military missions that hadn't been publicized. So you had this one going on in Cameroon. And actually, German politicians argued that they should have withdrawn from Cameroon a long time ago because this was becoming a hazardous environment. You have been having an uptick in terrorist attacks, and the German army was still engaged there. There have also then been German troops in Tunisia, something that there hasn't been a lot of light shed on until now. They've been there training and advising the troops there. There's been German troops in Niger as well. Working there, which they do have an open military mission in Mali just next door. And so, and also then Germany participates in the NATO military exercises Flintlock with African countries. So anyway, you've got more military missions, more training missions, more engagement in this area in North Africa than was previously realized.
So over the years, Gerald Flory's talked about the prophecies of the Bible that show Germany's involvement in the Middle East and, you know, taking some very drastic moves in that part of the world. But we've already seen deployments in North Africa and throughout that region in small numbers. This shows maybe a greater commitment Germany has had to that region than we've realized.
That's right. In April 2013, Mr. Flory had an article, Watch Algeria, and he started there, North Africa is turning into a battleground with enormously important prophetic implications. And he basically talked about this whole region building into a clash, the way you've got radical Islam backed by Iran spreading throughout this region. And he said, watch this area, because Germany's also involved in this region. It sees that coming. It's preparing for a clash with radical Islam. He said, he turned to some scriptures in Daniel 11 that showed, Germany is preparing already right now for this clash, and a good chunk of that revolves around North Africa. It's somewhere that's very important for Europe. And we've seen a lot of evidence of that since then already. Mali is one of Germany's most significant military deployments overseas. They've got hundreds of troops there, or at least a couple of hundred, leading the European troop training mission, leading the European civilian training mission. You've got German generals saying, look, we really need to build up Mali so that we've got a launch pad, as we might have to get involved in Libya and in some other areas. Now what we're seeing is just even more, and then there's a whole bunch of other military deployments that were public. Now we've got even more. And we're seeing that Germany is so committed to this area that they're willing to go in there in secret, that they're willing to find ways to kind of get around these constitutional provisions,
right,
and get in there and not tell anyone about it. They're very determined to be in there. They're very determined to form links with these other militaries. You've got the G5 Sahel force, for example, which is where German and French money and American is paying to create this border force that can go and target terrorists across a whole region, not just in one country. So you're seeing them involved in the area, but also just really training the armies of this area to the point that you've got country after country after country has had their military now trained by German soldiers and to a lesser degree French soldiers. So a huge amount of preparation. And that's right in line with those prophecies that Mr. Flory drew attention to in that Watch Algeria, that again said that they're going to confront Iran and they're preparing right now to do so. You don't see a lot of headlines about that because that's not something that our press pays attention to. But there's more and more evidence that they are preparing for that clash in advance, exactly the way the Bible says.
Well, quite fascinating to see that develop there. And we will put a link in the show notes for the program to that article by Gerald Flory, Watch Algeria. The point that you brought out that about their determination to get this done and the fact that what they're doing shows they're going to, even if it means covering up those activities or shielding them from their own parliament, it is quite extraordinary to see that manifestation of that determination. We appreciate that very much, Richard. Japan's impressive militarization took another step forward this week. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was a big week for the Japanese military machine. They launched an 8,200-ton Maya-class guided missile destroyer. That's the second of two recently improved Atago-class destroyers that Japan has developed. This one is called the Hagaru, which means something like strayer. It's fitted I think it's a really stunning array of weaponry. This has the Aegis baseline J-7 combat system. It also has what appears to be one of the most high-end Northrop Grumman radar systems, which can track all kinds of anti-ship missiles, including low-flying supersonic ones. It'll have SM-6 interceptors and also the RIM-162 Evolved Sea Sparrow missile. And it's also equipped with advanced electronic warfare capabilities. So building the Hagaru cost Japan about $1.6 billion. But when you see, just how it's decked out with this really top-of-the-line weaponry, I think it's easy to see how it would be that expensive.
So yet again, another milestone in Japan's larger goal to remilitarize.
Right. Yeah, it was just a little over 70 years ago now that Japan and its, its notoriously fanatical military machine was crushed out by the U.S. and its allies at the end of World War II. And of course, the U.S. then made Japan renounce war and enshrine pacifism into its constitution. And in the beginning, that truly was a binding restriction on the Japanese. But little by little, over the years, the Japanese have made these small and quiet moves toward rearming. They've quietly reinterpreted that part of their constitution. They've found creative ways to justify all kinds of steps, small and large, toward returning to militarism and toward developing key weaponry like this destroyer we're talking about here. And of course, this is just the latest bit of weaponry. We spoke just last month about all those F-35s that Japan is buying, 142 of them. That's one of the most advanced pieces of weaponry mankind has ever made. And now Japan is armed to the teeth with those. It has aircraft carriers to move them around on, those Izumo-class warships that they're developing now. Japan has V-22 Ospreys, Aegis Ashore missiles. It even has an overseas military base in Djibouti there in Africa. And Japan keeps on boosting its defense budget to maintain this expansion. So if you look at Japan today, it's really, a joke to call it a demilitarized pacifist nation. By most metrics, it's the world's sixth most powerful military. Mm-hmm. So it has happened stealthily, that remilitarization, but it has happened in a dramatic way.
The Trumpet has a trend article called Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism that explains why we're watching this from the standpoint of biblical prophecy. Maybe you could summarize that.
Yeah, sure. It goes through a bit of that history with World War II and how we've let Japan remilitarize. And we also put it in context of what the Bible says about this end time Asian power block that will form and be one of the main powers in World War III. Numerous prophecies talk about that. One of them in Ezekiel 38 gets very specific about which countries will be in this block. And it shows that Russia and China will be, you know, mainly Russia will be the lead nation, China kind of a junior position of leadership. And in verse 6 of Ezekiel 38, it mentions some ancient names for modern Japan. So when we see all this militarization in Japan happening, it is setting the stage for that end-time Asian bloc to be very, very powerful.
Hmm. Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. We'll have a link to that, Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism, in the show notes for the program today. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt made an interesting announcement. Many see it as a hopeful sign regarding Egypt's future. To learn about it and put it in prophetic context, we'll go back to Anthony Chibadirwe.
Yeah, the statement that the Brotherhood issued had many people perplexed and confused and worried and some excited. And it actually made that statement back in June 29th, but we started learning a whole lot more about it just this week. And what it said in that statement is that it would no longer seek to claim power after the regime of the current president, President al-Sisi. It said that it will no longer try to seek power. It said that it will stop any political activity in the country and allow its members to engage in political action through other parties. And as you indicated, some people might think that this is actually going to weaken the Brotherhood. This is the Muslim Brotherhood essentially throwing in the towel and giving up the fight. But what it's actually planning to do or trying to do is unifying the revolutionary camp. That's what it also said in its statement, which is the opposition. So it's trying to engage with the opposition, try to blend with the opposition. It also said that what it will do will act as a, it will now act as a general national movement with an Islamic background, supporting the nation and practicing political life in its general framework. Now, the Jamestown Foundation, it had an article about it, and what it links this to the death of Mohamed Morsi in June.
Right.
He died in June 17, and it was saying that prior to his death, the Brotherhood's main claim was, or main demand in Egypt was, Morsi should be reinstated as the president of Egypt. That was its main goal. But now he is out of the picture, and this is now an opportunity for the Brotherhood to change tactics, and this is the tactic, the new strategy that that the Brotherhood has sought.
Yeah, when Morsi came to power after Mubarak was ousted, this was we jumped right on that because of the biblical prophecies showing the radicalization of Egypt, the alignment of Egypt with Iran in the radical Islamic camp, and the Muslim Brotherhood's seizure of power under those circumstances really aligned perfectly with what we were expecting. What's happened since then has been more complicated. The fact that the Brotherhood, is, just because we are based on Bible prophecy, looking for that radicalization within Egypt, you can't help but look at this differently than somebody who would just take what the Muslim Brotherhood is saying at face value.
Just going back to the Brotherhood coming to power, that was a good indication of the strong Islamic sentiment within Egypt.
Right.
Egyptians voted for him. He did not come in through a coup. He was voted into power.
Yeah.
And the Brotherhood understands that there is a lot of that Islamist sentiment in Egypt, and it's essentially trying to diffuse it. There's an article that I read that said that this is actually one of the Brotherhood's political strategies for survival whenever it's facing a ban. It encourages it gave an example of one Brotherhood official who joined a party that had that wasn't really ideologically connected or similar to the Brotherhood, but then he rose in the ranks of that party and became second in command, and that way they spread their influence more throughout the nation. So it seems like this is a new strategy that they are working on. And as you brought out, the Bible does talk about this. We often talk about Daniel 11 verse 40, and it talks about this clash with the king of the north and the king of the south. And the king of the south, it's a radical Islam led by Iran. And the verses that follow that talk about Egypt being a part of that radical Islamic alliance, and that's why we've been watching these Islamic movements in Egypt, and we continue to watch them because they are going to be connected to Iran. Mm-hmm. If our listeners want to learn more about this, they can go to thetrumpet.com and read a trend article that's titled "Why the Trumpet Watches Iran Allying with Egypt."
Terrific. Thank you very much for that, Anthony. One final story. Religious persecution is rising worldwide, and the Trump administration showed its desire to do something about it. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it's easy to take for granted just how rare religious freedom is. 300 years ago, it was found almost nowhere on Earth. And today, even 80% of the world's population lives in a country that does not offer freedom of religion. And even in America over the past several years, especially under the Obama administration, there had been concerning signs about like the Affordable Health Care Act forcing Christian companies to pay for their employees' abortions, and then state-level rules criminalizing people who didn't support homosexual marriage in schools and other officials. And so the Trump administration is definitely working to push back against that, not just in America, but around the world. On Wednesday, President Trump met with 27 people in the Oval Office who had been persecuted for their religion. Most of them were Christians from communist or Middle Eastern nations. There were also some Jews from Yemen and Muslims from China who had been persecuted for their religion, that the Trump administration was meeting with, listening to their stories, and preparing for an announcement they were going to make the next day, where the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, got out and announced plans to create an International Religious Freedom Alliance. This is like an alliance of nations who are supposed to be dedicated to preserving religious freedom around the world, even to the point of possibly sanctioning nations that don't offer their citizens religious freedom. The Vice President Mike Pence had highlighted how they've already sanctioned a few Iranian citizens who are leading Islamic militias in Syria and Iraq. And there's even discussions of sanctioning some fairly high-level Chinese officials for their crackdown on religious freedom in that country, which relations with China are already tense over trade negotiations and stuff like that, so that definitely won't help that trend. But the fact that the Trump administration be almost being able to risk China's ire to stand up for something like this just shows just how serious they're talking about enforcing this religious freedom around the world.
We have an article that is slated to be in the print edition probably this coming issue that we're putting together right now, that just talks about how the American history and the American Constitution is so unique in that it does safeguard religious freedom. As you said, it's a very rare thing for people to be able to practice religion as they see fit, And America really has kind of been unique in that way, in leading the way.
Yeah, our founder of our church, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, even makes that point very powerfully in his book Mystery of the Ages, where he's talking about the church history, and when God's Sabbath keeping church first came to America back in 1664. Making the point that at the time they set up their first congregation in Rhode Island because it was the only place on earth that offered religious freedom as a tenant of its colonial charter. Hmm. And the American First Amendment is based off, at least that above guaranteeing religious freedom, is based off that part of Rhode Island's colonial charter. Hmm. So it's very uniquely American. It's been a huge blessing to God's church over the past 2.5 centuries. But it's definitely something that we need to be grateful for and enjoy it while it lasts, because there is a definite prophecy made by the greatest prophet of all time, Jesus Christ, in Matthew 24, where he's talking about that they shall deliver you up to be afflicted and even kill you, and you will be hated in all nations for my name's sake. So he's talking about religious persecution against God's church in all nations, and America is indeed a nation. So this is something that a huge blessing we're enjoying now, but it won't always be available.
Mm. Well, thank you for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour on thetrumpet.com. Our hub there has links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibatterway, and Richard Palmer. And thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Baltasar Gracian. It's better to sleep on things beforehand then lie awake about them afterward. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.